cute story told about a religious education teacher who was teaching her kids and decided that she wanted to see how much they'd taken on board, which she'd been talking about. And she says, you know, boys and girls, we're going to give you a time now to do some drawing. And I'd like you to draw a picture from the Bible that for you speaks of what God is like. And so they all dutifully pulled out a piece of paper and crayons and were making these lovely pictures. And being a good teacher, she went around the classroom looking over the shoulders of each of them, you know, encouraging them. But then she stopped when she saw what little Timmy was doing, because she couldn't figure out what he's trying to draw. Because to her eyes, it was a plane with four people in it. So she said, Timmy, what you doing? I'm drawing a picture of God. He said, okay, could you explain the picture? Yep. That's the plane, and that's Joseph and Mary and Jesus on their flight to Egypt. Okay, but who's the fourth person? Well, this, he stood up and put his hands on his hip. Mrs. Smith, you know who that is. That's Pontius, the pilot. So I'd like to start off with a question for you. What is your image of God today? My guess is that you, like many of us as children, grew up with images that were incomplete. Some of them were downright incorrect. Some were left us with a lot of fear, misunderstanding, and lacking the ability to even explain what God was really like. But what image do you have of God today? Just think about that for a moment. Or perhaps you could even multiply. What images do you have of God? Recognizing that no image or metaphor captures the mystery or the fullness of what God is about, you can relax because there's no correct image. Okay, there are definitely incorrect images, incomplete images. So would you take a few moments, turn to the person next to you, and share what that image or two is of God that you have today. This question was not meant to be a trick question in any way, but it's meant to help point to each one of us something that's very important. What you say about God and your image of God says a lot more about you than God. Okay? In other words, your image of God is greatly influenced by your own life experience, your perspective of reality. And referring back to the Talmud, where it beautifully says, we see things not as they are, but as we are. And certainly when it comes to the divine, that is absolutely true. So God is a subscript. It's a summary word we use to describe mystery, the unknown, the intangible. And so whether we're speaking from philosophy or theology or life experience or religion, you're going to get different answers. So distrust anyone who tells you, I know who God is. I know what God is about. Okay, because God is ultimate mystery. Even the wonderful mystics and saints approach God and any language of God with great reverence and humility. And that's what the second commandment is about. Don't think you know who God is. Be very careful when you talk about God. Okay? So Catherine of Siena, certainly no lightweight in this whole area, says that our image of God and our image of ourself are intimately connected. Think of like a coin. They're two sides of the same coin. That as your image of yourself changes, your image of God necessarily changes, and vice versa. And so as we approach this topic this morning, I just invite you to join me in truly being reverent as we talk about this whole area. So we're going to use words and images and a couple of different experiences to be able to try and wrestle. I like that word. I know it's a male word, but wrestle with this understanding of God. In no way thinking that, okay, now I got it. But perhaps there'll be a greater gentleness and respect, not only for mystery, but for ourselves as well as we approach this topic. I love the books you choose each semester. You have great choice. Great, great taste. And I especially love this book, The Divine Dance. So I'd like to begin with a psalm, contemporary psalm by a lovely woman named Edwina Gately. Have you heard of her? Okay, you have. Okay. This one comes from her book, Psalms of a Laywoman. It's entitled Silent Presence. This is her image of God. And you can hear, if you know about her ministry, you can hear her ministry is what's changing her image and experience of God. I thought, it's called Silent Presence, I thought that God had come to me, that after the wild delights and the suffering and the joys and the pain and the hopelessness of the years, that God had come to me. That after adventure and achievement, pain, despair, and death, God had come to me. Yes, with relief and mild surprise, I met my God again. And then I saw, oh fool, I saw, that God had suffered the pain and hopelessness, had shared the achievements and the joys, that God, all enveloping, all compassion, had been there in silence. All the time. Had been there in silence all the time. Here's a woman who knows the experience of God. That part of our reverence stance towards mystery is that we must be careful whenever we say something with certainty on one side, there's always going to be a balance on the other because God is both and. God is both and. This is one of the great truths of Catholicism. This is what Jesus is all about. That Jesus joins together heaven and earth in his person, the material and the spiritual. And this both andness is what the mystics try and get across to us in these wonderful, vibrant words and images in their language. Things like a terrible beauty, an enlightened darkness. You know, what the heck is that? Again, mysterious words trying to capture mystery. So as we talk about God with reverence, we recognize that God is not an object. And yet some people talk about God as if God were an object. You know, we snap our fingers as if God's a cosmic bellhop. Yes, what can I do for you? Not at all. God is being itself. Being itself. Perhaps that's why we have been named human beings, to try and help us to begin to even think along those lines that we are engodded individuals. We're not God, but we're divinized beings called humans. I love this phrase that Rohr puts out, and that is, God is the unhindered love in relationship. God is the unhindered flow of love in relationship. It's a dynamic presence. It's an energetic movement. It's an aliveness. It's not static. God is not static. So you've probably heard this said in other quarters, and that is that God is a verb, not a noun. God is a verb, not a noun. So here is where we come in. We are a vibrant part of this flow. We are an intimate part of this flow, of this positive energy that we call mystery, God, love. And so, two great metaphors that are used in the scriptures and used in many of the prayers of the church are the metaphor of breath, Hebrew word ruah, and also dance, Greek word perichoresis. I love these words because, like God, they're vibrant. And so the authors of the scriptures saw that, wrestled with trying to find a metaphor that can, at some level, invite us into the mystery. So that we can, at some way, acknowledge and be present to what is. So this gift and blessing from our Jewish brothers and sisters is dynamic. And perhaps you remember reading, if you went all the way to the back of the book, about the Yahweh prayer. Okay, that wonderful way of recognizing that this is the only word in Hebrew where the tongue does not touch the palate, as a way of reverencing this mystery, ultimate mystery. And the theology behind it is that every human being comes in this life with the name of God spoken through their first breath. And every human being leaves this reality again with the name of God with the last breath. So let's practice that. Would you join me? I'm going to say it first to overemphasize how it works. But we breathe in and then breathe it out, so it's a two-syllable response. Yahweh. Let's just do that five times together. Ready? The second reason why this is such a powerful sense, image of God, is it reminds us of the intimacy of the divine. That literally God is within every breath we take. It's meant to comfort us and challenge us at the same time. There's that both andness again. If you have any breathing problems, or if you've ever could not catch your breath for whatever reason, you know how scary that is. And so what a wonderfully wise and insightful gift to say that God is breath. God is life within us and life through us. And the other thing that's so helpful about this particular image of God is the idea that we cannot exist without it. One of the signs that somebody has passed on the next realm is there's no breath. It's gone. We speak about this body being lifeless, without breath. Okay? The second image is dance. I love this one. It's so communal. And that brings us to our topic today. The mystery of the Trinity so often was, I don't know about you, but at least to me in Catholic school, elementary school, was it's a mystery, so we can't talk about it. And I remember raising my hand in second grade, asking sister to say a bit more about it. And that was her answer. It's a mystery. We can't talk about it. Obviously, she didn't know anything about it. She wanted to skip and go to the next thing. Okay? But I would say the opposite. It's a mystery. Therefore, we must talk about it. We must talk about it. Because it's deeply understandable. It's immersed in the human experience. It's immersed in the experience of the cosmos. The cosmos is relational at a microcosmic level and a macrocosmic level. So back to the image of the dance. Have any of you done a circle dance before? Some of you have. What was the experience like for you? What do you remember about the experience? It was fun, joy. Did any of you feel isolated or self-conscious or can't keep up? Okay. In my family, when we have gatherings, like we're going to be having a wedding in the family next month, we love to dance. We're a dancing family. And I'm one of those that I'm not very coordinated. So I have to watch my sister. I always put her in front of me when we do circle dances or use things. Watch her exactly how she's doing it. But I stop worrying about me. It's so much fun. Just to be with the group and get out there and dance. So think of this image. Here we have, we use the term person, but three persons who are dancing, arms on each other's shoulders, leaning in, but at the same time, leaning out. Leaning in and leaning out and reaching out for you. Come and join the dance. Very often, though, because of some incomplete, incorrect catechesis, I can't join the dance. I have to go to confession first. You know, when I get my act together, then I'll, but you know, I can't do it now. Wow. What a sad response in the face of such ultimate mystery and life and love. Do you see children doing that? I got to ask my mother for it. No, they jump right in. They jump right in. So perichoresis is a Greek word for sacred dance. There's a sacredness about Holy Communion of persons. This is why, my friends, from the Catholic perspective, from the Christian perspective, the Eucharist is the center of worship. Why? To remind us we are already in communion. We are already in communion. Not because we need it, but to remind us we're already in communion. Why Jesus said, come one, come all. Come one, come all. It's not about worthiness. It's about the goodness of God. That's what it's about. We've got our focus completely wrong. That in God's goodness, God cannot not love. And so God is excited about having you, having us, join the dance. We are invited into the experience of this energetic flow, not just once, but over and over and over and over again. Yes? Yep. Well said. Exactly. Yeah. They hear the music. Their bodies are moving. Let's go out. Absolutely. And usually it's us crusty old ones that are judging people how well they're danced or dressed or look or whatever. We want to stay with the negative energy. But the kids are caught up with that positive energy. And so that's my next point, is that we're invited into this energetic flow so that we can do what Jesus did. And that is to live the life of vulnerable communion. Vulnerable communion. You know? In order for us to be in communion, we have to let go of this negative resistance to the flow. The flow of God's life. The flow of God's love. Well, we summarize that in one word, the flow of God's Spirit. God's Spirit. So here's a very simple definition that I really appreciate Richard putting it so succinctly, that sin is anything whatsoever, thoughts, attitudes, behavior, memories, anything that blocks or impedes this flow of life, of love, of spirit. This is where you and I can refuse mutuality or reciprocity. We begin to choose to be negative, to resist giving in, you know, to resist giving in to that flow of life and love. There's something about the aging process that can tempt or drag any one of us down. Will we remain grumpy old people? That was my dad's nickname by his grandchildren. Grandpa Grumpy. It was strange, and I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that he loved to watch the news too much. And I told him that. I said, Dad, why don't you try letting go of watching, instead of 4 hours a day, can you cut it back to maybe 15 minutes? You see? So we have to really take a look at this, because this is an opposition to the negative flow. What is it in your life that you're resisting? What obstacles are you putting up to prevent you from truly living in this vulnerable communion? I think part of it, maybe a lot of it, is fear. Let's face it, we are much more vulnerable when we're older. So we have a lot of fear around, am I safe? You know, do I have enough money to make it to the end of my life? You know, I wonder about this, I worry about that. And this is why it's a challenge and why it's called a spiritual exercise. The challenge in the exercise is to keep doing whatever it takes for me to remain in the flow. So you want to know a wonderful, very traditional secret, and it's so simple. It's the practice of living in gratitude. That's what breaks up the obstacles into smaller aspects for our life. In Jewish liturgy, before they begin their liturgy, or maybe a better way to say it is, the beginning of their liturgy, they have what we Catholics would call a litany of thanksgiving. Very basic. It's something that I've adapted my own prayer and I offer you, and that is, as soon as you wake up, before you can allow all those, as the native peoples would say, those coyotes to come and pull away the wonderful dreams and positive experience of being asleep, just start thinking about what you're grateful for. So as you're standing up, what works? Okay, no pain this morning, thank you. Okay, all right, okay. I was able to go to the bathroom, okay, no pain, thank you. All right? Every little thing is an opportunity to once again get back into the flow, and to remain in the flow. And even when you're tempted to start whinging and complaining like the daughters and sons of Babylon about our political reality or our ecclesia reality, again, as quick as you can, come back into that flow. Back into that flow. So this is our spiritual practice, is that we are to work, and it's a right work. We are to work to allow this flow of love through us. And it is a work. You know, you'd think it'd be so easy, but it's a work because we want to keep saying, yes, but. That may be true, but, you know, it hasn't always worked for me, you know. But to work and to keep practicing allowing that love to flow through you. So, this is our true suffering. I thought that was a brilliant line that Rohr had. Our true suffering is giving up our autonomy for the sake of community. Now, ladies, I'd be very interested if we had time to sit down and ask you, what was it like when you got married and you had to move from thinking only of yourself to now thinking of another human being? In talking to a lot of men, I think it's harder for us men. I'll tell you why. Because whenever I've worked with couples preparing for marriage, and then afterwards, if it was like, say, marital counseling, no problem for the woman using plural. Okay? We, us, our. For the guy, invariably, I'd have to smile and interrupt and say, you know, isn't the two of you? Oh, that's right, yeah, us. Our. Or she'll do this to him, you know? So there's that dynamic of, even in those of you who are married, in your sacramental relationship, ideally you're allowing this flow of love to happen not only within you, but between you. But the challenge is, can you continue to let go of holding on so tightly to your autonomy and to embrace equally the flow into community, this back and forthness? And those of you who are widowed, you know in a different way where this community has been ripped from you and now you're back in the autonomy. Where do you go with that? So these aren't just theories. This isn't just theology. This is reality. How do you see and experience that reality happening within you and between you and your beloved, between you and your friend, between you and the ones who know and love you the most? In God, God holds this, can we use the word, perfect harmony between autonomy and communion. And that's why, from our perspective as human beings, We honor this by using very familial terms. Father, Son, Spirit. And again, you could use different words if you like. These come not only from tradition, but from philosophy. You can use Creator, Redeemer, Sanctifier. You can use any number of things that speak to you in your experience of ultimate mystery. What works for you? You can use feminine pronouns, masculine. Again, because God is mystery. And any word, any image, any metaphor limps in one way or another. So this mystery of the Trinity is an invitation for us to fully participate in our lives as they are. Not as we want them to be, but as they are. In our limitations, in our successes, our failures, to jump right in. To jump right in. How did you learn to swim? Were you one of those that, you know, you read a book and then you kind of figured out how to do it, you had an instructor? Or were you like my dad, you got thrown into the end of the pool? Okay, just do this, you know, from the shoreline. Just do that. No, that's not right. Do this. Oh, sorry about that. You know, sometimes that's what life does to us. You don't read a book about it, but you got to get put in the deep end of reality. And it's not that God has abandoned us, but God's saying, I'm hoping you're learning that if you want to be able to experience the fullness of your life, you have to participate. I'm not going to do it all for you. I gave you life, and we'll work on this together, but you've got to work with me. So you know, it's one of my favorite themes, but I'll repeat it, is that you and I are God's partners in God's life, just as much as God is a partner in our life. This is what relationship, this is what Trinity is all about. And that's why God's saying, come and join the dance. God will not do for you what you can do for yourself, what you must do for yourself. Perhaps that's why it's so hard for us to change. That when we're believers, we just assume, okay, you're going to do it all, God. No, not at all. Is that God and creation cooperate. Years ago, when I was in my late teens, my brother Tony and I traveled to my Uncle Tim's monastery in Huntsville, Utah. And we stayed for about a month, had a great time. We were there for so long, he kind of put us in charge of the other guests. And that meant we kind of assigned the guests different things to do and whatnot. But one day, we were put in charge of doing the dishes, the guest dishes. So Tony and I was washing, he was drying. And I happened to notice over my shoulder, two of the newer guests standing at the doorway into the kitchen. They didn't say a word. And so Tony kind of gave me a questioning look like, who are they? I had no idea. So we continued talking and washing. I'm not kidding you, I was down to the last two items to wash. The older of the two gentlemen stepped forward and said, can we help you? It was like, so we stifled a guffaw and just said, no, we're okay, thanks. So I went to my Uncle Tim and I says, who are those guys? He goes, oh, you know, in the monastery we get all types of people. He says, they come from a group that believes you don't do anything without asking God first. They were standing there that whole time praying, should we ask them or not? Should we offer help or not? That's an extreme. That's not what we're talking about. There was an old heresy, I believe it was the 17th century, called Quietism, where it was very similar to that. You know, you just don't do anything, God will do it all. That's not true. Jesus did not live or profess a passivism. Okay? It was an assertive, interactive, interbeingness happening in him. Recognizing that this is what God is about. God is interacting with us as God interacts with the cosmos. So a full participation in reality is what we do with our life. A full participation in God is to join God in loving and suffering. In loving and suffering. So this speaks of the very heart of what many of us Catholics misunderstand. God doesn't want you to suffer. Not at all. Rather, God says, come and share with me what it's like to be a part of creation. To be a part of being embedded, immersed in the human condition. Come and experience what it means to be in communion. Come and experience what it means to be vulnerable. No, God doesn't punish us. God doesn't make us suffer. God doesn't want us to suffer. God says, come and fully participate in what it means for you to be human. So again, this is why we allow this love to flow through us, because we can't do it alone. We're not asked to do it alone. When we try and do it alone, that's called hell. And it feels like that. Think of the words that the mystics use when they describe this beautiful Trinitarian experience. Surrendering, trusting, yielding. Lovely words. Words that remind us it is interactive. Words that remind us that it's about allowing, letting go, opening up. Again and again. So the life of faith is the life of allowing God's love to flow through us and resting in that love. Do you know that's the most common word that's used by the mystics? Resting. Resting in that. The second most common is floating. Floating. You ever done the back float? When you first learn it, it's pretty scary. It's like, am I going to fall and go underneath the water? But eventually, when you truly practice it, you realize, this is pretty cool. It lessens the energy, but allows you to enjoy the experience. And that's what we're supposed to do with God, is to enjoy God. You ever thought about that? I was never told that as a kid. I wasn't told that as a seminarian. Wasn't told that as a priest. Had to come to the experience myself. So you're probably like this. You know, in Africa, the catechism they use, which is a little bit different than the one we use here in America, they have a question like we do, why did God create you? Do you know the answer in the African catechism? because God thought you might enjoy it. Isn't that great? I love that. Because God thought you might enjoy it. God wants you to enjoy God and to enjoy your life. Now, you may say, Brother Jim, you don't know the suffering in my life. I don't. But that's why time and time again we're invited into this mystery of loss and renewal, death and resurrection, this and that. We can choose to live in the past, or we can choose to live in the present. Again, the choice is ours. To live in the past is a hellish experience because we were not created for the past. We were not created for the future. We, like the Creator, were created for this moment. And this is called presence. Being present to what is. Present to the one who is most present. Those of you who are Catholic, you know this. For we have such a great reverence, for we call it the sacred presence, or the Eucharistic presence, or the presence in the tabernacle. Over and over and over again. We cannot experience that presence unless we're present to ourselves. Is that this is meant to be for us how we live our life. So when you trust God, when you trust God, that you are being guided by God, you recognize something very important, and that is that you are in a force field called God. That God is guiding you almost in spite of yourself. And that when you begin to see this, you can rest even more. You can float in that awareness, knowing that you're being held by God. Even when you make mistakes, even when things don't go the way you hope, you expect, you pray, whatever it may be. But to sit with that and to know, wow, this is more than I thought. My friends, that's why we pray. We pray because it's meant to be like the breath or the pause. We take a step back and realize this energy, this force field, this life, this love is inviting us to pay attention. Pay attention. And those things that we call, wasn't that a coincidence? Not coincidence. It's when God chooses to remain anonymous. That's a coincidence. You see? It's just that you finally opened yourself up to something that seems magical, mysterious, lovely. So the Spirit is present when there is communion, koinonia, fellowship. This is what Eucharist is all about. And why, whenever you come to Eucharist, in whatever way, shape, or form, you leave experiencing something different about you, about God, hopefully about the faith community as well. And why, at some level, if you're cognizant of it, you are experiencing the same thing at home in your own domestic Eucharistic experiences. In the sharing of food and drink and meaningful conversation, you realize, yes, this is what nourishes me. This is what reminds me to trust in this process of being appropriately vulnerable and experiencing communion. So two ways to break through into this new way of knowing, this intimate experience of the Godhead. This experience of being involved in the perichoresis is through awe and wonder, which is a drawing upwards, and through suffering, which is a drawing downwards. There is that intimate tension, once again, that both andness. Awe and wonder first came to us when we were kids, where we were just in awe of the lights in the sky, or little bugs, or a big tree, or music. And it's different for every child. Believe it or not, that little child still exists inside of you. And that little child is still feels and is drawn to seek out awe and wonder. When's the last time you allowed yourself to be filled with awe and wonder? Often, we tend to trust this part of our being, just the intellect. I need to understand it first. Okay? Perhaps the one place where we can still be touched with awe and wonder is in nature, or through wild animals. Okay? Awe and wonder is meant to open us up to the vast mystery of not only what's beyond us, but within us, what we call the depth of being human. This is why C.G. Jung said his whole field of study started because religious people, especially Christians, did not want to look at that depth inside. They were especially afraid of what we had called instinctual values and experiences. How sad. How sad. Because what's out here is a mirror, a reflection of what's inside, and vice versa, the back and forthness. The second one, human suffering. Suffering reminds us we're not the creator. We're not God. Is that we are creatures. We are limited. We're finite. And that in itself is suffering. Because we're already thinking about suffering and death and what's going to happen next and all these decisions. You know, a non-sensate being, they don't think about that. They just enjoy life as it is. So this is a regular daily occurrence of joining together the material reality and the spiritual reality within our own personhood, just as Jesus did. He never said, you know, sit down, take a break, I'll do it for you. Never said that. He said, come and follow me. Take responsibility for your life and come on, follow me. I'll show you how to do it. I'm not going to do it for you, but we're going to do it together. So God, in God's self, is perfect giving and receiving. This is why when you give something of yourself to another, you feel this connection. And when you receive it from another, you feel this connection. And it's a vulnerable place to be. You want to say, I owe you. Or I'll get the bill next time. You know, I'll do this. No, it's pure gift. It's pure gift. You know? To receive it and then to pass it on, that is the work of an ungodded human being. To receive it and then pass it on. The Creator is God for us, or the gaze of love given. Jesus is God alongside us, and is the gaze of love returned. Spirit is God within us, the gaze of love returned. So I'd like us to practice this great gift. And I know this is going to make you feel uncomfortable, so let's just admit it. It's going to be uncomfortable, and now we're done with that, we're going to do it. Because we rarely think ourselves in a new way of behaving. We tend to behave or act our way into a new way of thinking. Wouldn't you agree? It's kind of foisted on us. So I'd like you to be able to move your chair and turn and face someone. Just only one other person. Turn and face another person. Probably close to you. So as you're getting seated and comfortable in front of your partner here, let me tell you a story. There was a magazine reporter who wanted to interview this Native American chief. And he said, sure, as long as you agree to allow me to look at you. And the magazine reporter was rather surprised. He said, well, yeah, okay. He figured, okay, he's going to come and see him in person. But he sat before the chief, and the chief looked at him without moving a muscle for 2 hours. And he said, okay, I'm ready for the interview now. So this is what we'd call a contemplative gaze. So I'd like you to just both close your eyes. I'd like you to connect with the divine love that's inside of you already. This flow of love we've been talking about, that you've read about. And I know that you experience the times in your life. And when you open your eyes, not yet, but when you open your eyes, I'm going to ask you to allow that flow of love to flow through your eyes, your body. And just look at this person across from you. Allow that energy to flow through you. And even when you're feeling comfortable, stay with the presence. Okay, please open your eyes and allow that love to flow through you as you look at the other person across from you. Would you share with your partner what that was like for you? Just share with your partner what that was like for you. The gaze of love is so disarming. It's so seminal to the human experience that when it happens and it's done well, it heals us, profoundly heals us. It brings us back to that gaze of love between mother and child, father and child. I know a man who, his father rejected him, actually told him, "You're not my son." And he's carried that wound. He's in his 40s now, throughout his life, and thankfully we had a powerful ritual in the community of men where he experienced a deep healing. But you want to know what he does with his two little kids, a boy and a girl, and they're about that high. Okay, it's like whatever age that is, about maybe 7 or so. He sits them up on the kitchen counter and he just looks at them right in the eye. And what's so powerful is they don't turn away from him. They don't say, "Oh, Daddy, stop that." They take it on board. The flip side, when I was getting my degree in counseling, we were shown this video. Yes, back then they were videos. They weren't DVDs. But off camera, the psychologist was explaining what was going on. And it was the father was off sight. And in front of him was his own child. It was a boy child in a bassinet. And the psychologist had told him, "Just keep looking at your son no matter what he does." He did a typical thing that kids would do. He was smiling and he was throwing his arms around and kicking and all the things he'd normally do. And then just a very ordinary encounter. Very lovely. Then the psychologist said, "Now just turn your head. And no matter what your son does, don't turn back." It was so painful to watch. The kid did the exact same thing, repeated the same movements, then started to exaggerate them. Started to throw his arms even more. Kick his legs. Then here's what he did. He went like this. He was yearning for the gaze of love. It wasn't given. Something's the matter with me. And that's what the psychologist said. You have just seen what shame looks like. When we internalize, something's the matter with me. You have just given a wonderful gift to your partner, even though it was uncomfortable. You brought them back to the fact that I'm worthy of the gaze. You know, I'm worthy of the gaze because of who I am. That is what authentic prayer is once again getting in that flow of love by receiving the gaze of the Creator and returning it back. And that ideally, when you have finished your prayer, wherever you look, you do the same thing to others. You see them for who they are in this moment. You bless them by being attentive to them. Not just by listening, but by the way you are present. Let's face it, we're in a hurry, we don't do that. And one of the things that, because I do a lot of driving, I think that's why we can be maniacs on the road and be so kind and gentle outside our vehicle. Because we don't see, especially if they've got the tinted windows and whatnot, we don't see. And so we click into a completely different energy field. I got to get ahead of this car, you know? I got to get there on time, whatever it may be. And we lose that sense of relationality. So this is why theologically we use a relational term, speaking about God as Father, or God as Mother, okay? Or God as all-embracing love. Because what we're trying to say is God, ultimate mystery, is the One, the Being, that encloses us, that believes in us, that sustains us, that trusts us, who is wholly beyond us. One morning I was praying and I was really taken up in the joy and the delight of just having this alone time with God. And I made up my own little psalm. Just say, you know, God, you're so awesome. You know, you're so beautiful, you're so wise, so holy. Thank you for being you. I was not ready for what came back to me like a mirror. The exact same words. Halfway through, I said, God, you can't say that. That's what woke me up, is we seem to interrupt the flow of love because we go back to that internalized shame. We focus on something I did do or I didn't do or I forgot to do rather than the love force that's there. God loves you not because you're good. God loves you because God's good. There's nothing you have done or will ever do that can separate you from that love. Don't take my word for it. Look at Romans 8. It's very clear. Nothing can separate you from that love. Because that's who God is. God is that life force, that love. So this work is a template for reality. And as Rohr says, when you step into it, it changes your whole perception of the cosmos. Your whole perception of yourself. In this moment, this experience. That it's not about waiting for the future when you die and I hope I get to heaven. No. It's heaven all the way to heaven and it's hell all the way to hell. Catherine Siena's words again. We participate in the mystery right now. Your heavenly moments are when you see. That's why so many of these writers speak about an awareness. When you see or you hear or you know this truth, you've experienced it. And you stand in awe. In awe. Sometimes it happens in nature. Sometimes it happens in the intimate embrace of two lovers. Sometimes it happens in the gaze of love between you and another human being. Sometimes it happens in a moment of prayer. It comes and it goes. So this is why you find that the graduate level of prayer is called contemplation. Observing reality as it is. Not trying to change it. Accepting it. Knowing it. Delighting in it. And why? The contemplative life, very simply, is desiring a daily, abiding awareness of God's great love. According to Merton, these are the three principles of the contemplative life. There are moments that we are blessed with a taste of depth that is characterized that this moment is holy. This moment is enough. This moment is perfect. And it can be painful or joyful. We just know there's depth here. This is real. Secondly, in this holy moment, I'm tasting and knowing that all moments are holy. That all moments are enough. I become painfully aware of how ignorant I am of this awareness. That all moments are holy. So those are the challenges of the contemplative life. So to bring this to conclusion, being with this flow is called a mystical communion. Allowing oneself to be taken up in this flow is a letting go and a yielding, a surrendering to that divine presence that's already there. It's not about deserving it, it's pure gift. And you learn slowly that how you do the God thing is how you do the human thing. They're intimately connected. And so this is why our proper response is somewhere, somehow, let this flow happen through you, always and everywhere. It could be with your dog. It could be with a flower in your garden. It could be with a rock. It could be with individual people. It could be with the clouds, but you just let it flow. God loves you perfectly and completely. And this flow is constant and total. And God says, will you let me do this work through you as well? It doesn't change because of your actions. We are to trust this love, to stand on it. The word we use is believe in it and to surrender to it. God will use everything in your life, including your shortcomings, to get you into the dance. To get you to breathe deeply. So I leave you with this final thought from Catherine Lacugna. It's her last sentence in her tome on the Trinity. The very nature of God is to seek out possible communion of friendship with every last creature on earth. The very nature of God is to seek out the deepest possible communion and friendship with every last creature on earth. How about it? Do you allow God to be in communion with you, to flow through you? I hope so. Let's take a break.